This is the bicentennial anniversary of the War of 1812, one of the least understood of all of the conflicts our country has been engaged in. Although its official cause was the British impressments of American sailors, the real reasons for it were a lot more complicated, and much of the war was fought at sea, with the 20 ships in the United States Navy having to contend with 1,000 British man-of-wars. It was to be the last war where ships under sail would play such a large part. In his book called Knights of the Sea, David Hanna explores the causes of the conflict and describes a single battle which took place off the coast of Maine between the USS Enterprise and the British brig Boxer. It's published by Penguin Group in its Caliber imprint, and I'm very pleased that it's brought David Hanna to our show today. Hello.
How are you, Leonard?
Should we think of the War of 1812 as a continuation of the War of Independence?
I think in some respects, yes. I don't think Britain fully respected American sovereign rights at sea, and our commitments abroad in terms of trade and whatnot were significant. And I also feel that the unresolved issues involving the Native American tribes in the Northwestern territories in particular, I mean, this was a holdover. The British had sort of kicked the can down the road, and it was something that eventually had to be dealt with one way or the other.
So the French and Indian Wars, the War of Independence, and now the War of 1812, all part of some kind of similar thing that leads all the way, I guess, into the 19th century with the Indian Wars and whatever else. But you call it a quasi-civil war.
Yeah, I mean, at that time, the population of the United States was it was heterogeneous, but it was certainly more homogeneous than it is today. And a lot of the families, particularly in places like New England and in the Tidewater South, they had, you know, ties with family back in the British Isles and in England itself.
So they actually were opposed to any thought of war. But weren't they in New England, which relied on going to sea? So much of industry in New England had to do with the shipping. Weren't they concerned about the impressment of American sailors?
They did. It was interesting. I was thinking about this on the walk over. And, you know, they, on the one hand, it's true that the seamen that were getting impressed oftentimes were, you know, the fathers and sons and sweethearts of families in New England, primarily, not entirely. You had ports like Philadelphia, Baltimore, of course, that also had significant ties to Europe in Atlantic trade. But on the other hand, yeah, I mean, the business interests were, you know, tied with trade with Britain. Britain ruled the seas, and their empire was so far flung, and there was so much money to be made, and crossing Britain just wasn't good business.
And the British also believed that we should have joined them in fighting Napoleon.
Yes, they did, and I think a lot of New Englanders would have agreed with them. You know, one of the things that sometimes when, you know, sort of revisionists look back at the War of 1812, one thing that people sometimes will seize on is the strong anti-war sentiment in New England. I mean, it was really deep. But it would be mistaken to see that as anti-war sentiment against war in general. It wasn't pacifist. If Madison had been calling for war with Napoleon, I think there would have been a lot of strong sentiment for that.
Despite the fact that the French had aided us so much in the War of Independence?
I think the France of that time, you know, the Bourbon France, was seen, you know, in the rearview mirror in a very different way following what happened with, you know, Robespierre, the Reign of Terror. It just, you know, stained the reputation of France in so many ways. And then, of course, the XYZ affair and the quasi-war with France in the 1790s at sea when Adams was president.
Didn't the British recognize that their actions might provoke the United States into resisting them at least?
They did. And the thing was that, I mean, it was, looking at it from the British perspective, they must have been so frustrated because, you know, it was almost like their children or their wayward children essentially were just being so willful, insisting. And the thing is, you know, it's interesting. We did the same thing in World War I, that we insisted on the right to travel where we pleased, trade with who we pleased, and be neutral. I mean, when you're talking about, you know, this was the struggle that, you know, Britain was waging was, you know,
Washington, you know, had warned against any entangling alliances, and I assume that many people subscribe to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I understand why people felt that way in the United States, but I'm just saying from the British point of view, it just seemed like a, you know, it was almost a luxury to for the United States to have, you know, those rights, and they were, in a life and death struggle with what they saw as a tyrant who was aimed at, you know, world domination.
But also, I'm assuming they thought that our military strength was so negligible at the time that they didn't really care whether we declared war or not.
And it was. It was. I mean, if you look at the incompetence of our forces in the multiple invasions of Canada, I mean, it was a fiasco. But at sea, they miscalculated.
Now, you mentioned the multiple invasions of Canada. That's one of the aspects of this story that Americans don't know very much about. In fact, you say that the War of 1812 is one of the least understood conflicts that either the United States or Great Britain were ever involved with. And a lot of it has to do with Canada. Do Canadians see this war differently than we do in this country?
Vastly differently. They see this as the defining moment for them becoming a nation. And they should. You know, one of the claims they make, which is a little overblown, is that they won the war. I've talked to Canadian friends about it. By the way, we won the war. And
well, they occupied Detroit, didn't they?
Temporarily. But I mean, if winning the war meant resisting American hegemony, maintaining your own national identity, then they won the war. They could claim victory, certainly. But it was mostly, when this is an important point, it was mostly won by British arms. The actual Canadian military contribution wasn't that large.
But Canada at that point was just simply an extension of Great Britain. They hadn't gained their own independence as we had. But if to the United States, the young United States, did they see expansion into Canada as an important factor?
I don't know if necessarily important. I think that making sure that the British weren't arming and instigating the Native American tribes in the Northwest. But a lot of people, including Jefferson, who, you know, we don't think of as being someone who was necessarily an expansionist in a military sense, he felt that, you know, Canada would just, at least Upper Canada, Ontario, today's Ontario, not French-speaking Canada, would fall like a ripe fruit, that it would just sort of happen. But, of course, that didn't.
Well, wasn't Jefferson kindlier toward France? He loved living there, and then he made a deal with Napoleon that gave us an awful lot of territory.
He certainly was. He was somebody who sort of, you know, he and his you know, I guess his class in Virginia, they sort of aped British culture, and yet he rejected their ideology. He embraced France's ideology. Even after he realized the excesses that had happened, he still couldn't quite distance himself entirely from it.
So who was for this war? Madison? Monroe?
Madison is, you know, this is something that, I think that a lot of people misunderstand that Madison came out on principle and insisted on, you know, asserting American rights. And those are the stated reasons. But the thing is that in 1807, and of course he was Jefferson's right-hand man, in 1807 when the Leopard, a British ship, had stopped an American ship and fired on it even though its gun ports were closed because they didn't want to show that they were possibly acting aggressively, was fired on at point-blank range, and an American seaman died. That was it. I mean, that was the provocation. If that was the time, if there was a desire to go to war over this issue, it was right then. And it didn't happen. So 5 years later, it happened. And what was going on was there was a new generation in the party that Jefferson had formed that had come up, guys like Henry Clay of Kentucky, John Calhoun of South Carolina, very dynamic, articulate. And they wanted war for different reasons.
From the South. Why would they want Canada?
Well, in the case of Clay, he wanted the Northwest, and he did mention he thought that a unit of Kentucky militia could take Canada. That was one of his famous quips. He came to regret that, I think. In the case of Calhoun, he wanted to expand King Cotton, and the Native American tribes in the Southeast, the Creeks, et cetera, were in the way, and the British were in contact with them and did arm them once the war began. And the idea was to take, you know, these lands and basically put them firmly under the control of the United States. And that had nothing to do with the war at sea.
Well, you mentioned that on the land we were a disaster, but we did well at sea. But weren't we really outmanned by the British? The British ruled the waves, didn't they?
We were, but not as outmanned as it might seem. And when you start, you know, you look at numbers, you know, there's numbers and there's numbers.
Is this kind of like the Spanish Armada with the with Queen Elizabeth's navy, where the Armada looked just so invincible because it was so big, but the British Navy was more maneuverable?
Not really. I mean, of course, the Spanish Armada was bent on invasion. The British, you know, the only real attempted invasion was in upstate New York, on, you know, along Lake Champlain. the burning of Washington, which of course everyone knows about, and the attack on Baltimore, that was really a raid, and a quite effective one. Like I said, with the numbers, that the British did have a huge advantage, yet they also had a lot more sea to patrol. So,
but they were, a lot of the battles were on the Great Lakes, weren't they?
Yes, of course, the lakes also, and you know that was an interesting conflict too, because you know that was really a howling wilderness in a lot of ways then, and they were just trying to build a fleet, if you want, or a squadron. It wasn't a fleet. And put it out to sea or on the lakes was not easy. I mean, it was just the capacity to do that just didn't really exist.
So at the outbreak of the war, did we have a lousy Navy? Did it improve over the brief span of this war?
No, our Navy was one of the finest in the world, if not the
finest.
From
the start?
Yeah. Not qualitatively, obviously not quantitatively.
My guest is David Hanna, H-A-N-N-A. His book, Knights of the Sea, The True Story of the Boxer and the Enterprise in the War of 1812, published by Caliber. And we will get to that battle after we take a little break. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Stay with us. We're back with David Hanna, whose book, Knights of the Sea, The True Story of the Boxer and the Enterprise in the War of 1812, is published by the Caliber imprint of Penguin Books. I get the feeling that because you say that the war was fought in the press, the streets, and the pulpit, that in some ways it was like Vietnam.
It was similar, but one of the major differences was that, again, the anti-war sentiment wasn't anti-war. It was anti-war with Britain. And other than that, though, yeah, the polarization
was conscription an issue?
The Madison administration floated the idea of adopting conscription because they just weren't able to meet the manpower needs of their commanders out on the frontier in Canada. And it just any talk of Webster, who was another rising star at this time, shot down any kind of talk of conscription. It just didn't even get to the floor in any serious way.
But James Madison almost seems to be the LBJ of this story.
He was I like to say he was a first rate founding father, but he was a second rate or third rate president. He was not a strong figure. He was not able to control the more dominant younger figures in his party, who were becoming the more dominant figures, particularly Clay. And you know, he also felt, was convinced by some people around him, that the war could be used as an election winner in 1812. That essentially, if you're not patriotic, if you're not for the war, and he thought that he could use that against the Federalists, which is interesting because it didn't work out that way. The Federalists actually made gains in the 1812 elections.
So that rally around the flag boys thing didn't work. There were riots in Baltimore, weren't there?
Yeah, well, these riots were quite different. These riots were pro-war. And they were against a newspaper that was a Federalist newspaper, their minority paper in Baltimore that came out strongly against the war on principle. And it was pretty savage, yeah.
Why in Baltimore?
Baltimore was a hotbed of support for France. And there's a number of reasons for that. Of course, the maritime trade. There was also a French emigre community there. I'm actually not particularly sure if it had to do with the Catholic roots of Baltimore's community either. But there was support there, and very truculent support for the war.
Well, in your case, you've written about a particular battle of the war. Why focus on that?
I grew up near the waters where the battle took place, within sight of the waters. My father was a painter, and he moved the family from his native Pennsylvania to Pemaquid Point.
And Pennsylvania plays a role in this story as well. It's kind of
it does. Well, the other end of he was from the western end, but of course Burroughs is a Philadelphian, the American commander in the battle. But he wanted to be near the sea, and we lived in the lighthouse keeper's house. As I understand it, we were the last family ever to live in the lighthouse keeper's house there, until we built our own home just up the peninsula ways.
And this is a battle that people actually could see from the shore.
Yeah, and not only that, they had time to gather, because Burroughs, the American commander, took his time getting just the right position. He had a plan of attack, which he executed brilliantly, even though ultimately he died or was grievously wounded and died soon after.
Well, both captains died as a result of the battle. It was memorialized by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow in a poem.
Yeah, Longfellow was 6 years old when the funeral before the Commanders took place in Portland, nearby. It's about, I'm not exactly sure how many miles it is, not far. And the funeral made a deep impression on him. He was named, actually.
The funeral was for both captains, and they were both treated with equal respect, which is interesting.
Yeah, it shows how much, you know, these were kindred peoples, and this, you know, there's no better example of the nature of this quasi civil war, I think, and that's been stated before. I mean, they were given the full honors. They're of course buried side by side in Monjoy Hill, and also one thing that was known to people in Portland and throughout the Maine coast was that Blythe, even though he was a nuisance out there in the waters, you know, preying on shipping, he actually had served as a pallbearer for James Lawrence of the Chesapeake, who had fallen in battle with the Shannon a few months before. And, you know, that was known. He'd volunteered to do that. And he was, of course, given full honors by the citizens of Halifax.
Now, what point in the war did this battle occur?
It took place in September, early September 1813, and it was a significant point because Lawrence, his defeat was a big moment for Britain. They felt like that, okay, these earlier victories by the Americans, you know, the Constitution, the United States, they'd won some significant single ship actions. These were anomalies. Now we're restoring the order of things here. And it was important for the Americans because the war at sea was the only place, really, that the Americans were doing well, and had, you know, and the morale factor was quite significant.
Now you go into the lives of both of these captains. We don't have a lot of time to look at them, but they both had to work hard to gain ships, didn't they? For different reasons. Blythe comes probably from a lower class family, interestingly, than Burroughs does, although I'm not sure that was class still an important British legacy in early America?
Well, it certainly was. I mean, in the case of Blythe, he was a commoner, and making that leap was very difficult to do. He did it mostly because he was a fire eater, and he was constantly in, you know, the news, and he had some powerful friends who eventually were able to get him, his ship. Well, actually, it was a brig. Whereas with Burroughs, it was a step down. I mean, he came from the elite of Philadelphia society. His father was a leading Federalist, a friend of John Adams.
And he liked to dress like a seaman sometimes and go out in the equivalent of disguise.
Yeah, there's a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde sort of, nature to Burroughs. Is his persona. I chose not to pursue that any further than I could find anything to corroborate any, you know, speculation that I might have.
It was assumed from the start by Americans that we would win this war. Why?
Because Britain was up to its neck trying to defeat Napoleon.
Mm-hmm. And so it was distracted by Napoleon. Well, why was Britain so effective then? Did they just have so many men under arms and at sea that they could do both?
Here's the irony that when you look at the beginning of the war, it looked like the Americans were not going to be effective at sea, and on land it would be a cakewalk. Whereas for the British, it would be the opposite. But actually what happened was is the American Navy and their officers in particular and crews were just very well trained and they were ready. And the British Army in Canada was actually very well led and was very effective trying to deal with multiple threats. Isaac Brock was really quite a remarkable figure. He's a Canadian national hero now, albeit a British.
He had a small British army, and he conquered Detroit. And there probably are some people in the auto industry who wish that they had continued to control that city.
One of the things he did is he used psychological warfare. He had the threat of, well, you know, maybe I won't be able to control my Native American allies. And that was a real fear because they would, they massacred, for instance, the garrison at Fort Dearborn, today Chicago. And this was something that he could use, you know, that, you know, if you want to me to keep my allies in check, you need to, basically, accept my terms as they are.
Now, it's suggested that this was a turning point in the war. Why?
It was a turning point in one sense, that the battle was a battle that the Americans needed to win because of what had happened earlier with the Chesapeake. They needed to show that these were not anomalies. The thing is that it's been overshadowed because just very, very shortly afterwards, Perry on Lake Erie won a great victory. And that's the victory we look at oftentimes as the victory that avenged Lawrence, whereas actually the Lawrence's defeat was avenged earlier by Burroughs.
David Hanna will be giving a reading and signing books tomorrow at 6 o'clock at the Corner Bookstore on Medicine Avenue between 92nd and 93rd Streets. His book, Knights of the Sea, The True Story of the Boxer and the Enterprise and the War of 1812, published by Caliber Books. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, Thomas Frank starts us off with a look at the unlikely revival of conservatism, and then Adam Gopnik takes us on a journey in search for the true meaning of food in our lives despite our obsession with it. Plus, we'll also explore fading ads on buildings all over the city. And we'll take a look at the role of social networking in modern life, for better or worse, including your calls on the issue, do you or don't you Facebook? The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan's the executive producer. We had help today from Christina Maldonado, Sarah Waltuck, and contributing producers Virginia Doris and Fran Jacobs. Debbie Fanta was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow.